Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 5:20 p.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones, especially the chairman. Present today, Senator Kaufman, no, Senator Kaufman not here, Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 66, Controlled Substances, Homicide, Crimes, and Sentencing, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is a third hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. During Monday's hearing on House Bill 66, there was a request to hear from the Department of Corrections to discuss their fiscal note. Present today from the Department of Corrections is, I actually don't have on my list, Terry, if you want to come forward, identify yourself for the record. And Senator Tobin, you had questions. I'll let you ask those questions.
Thank you for the record. My name is Terry West, Admin Services Director of the Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I was curious particularly about the sections of the underlying bill, House Bill 66, that talks about the increase of individuals that may be incarcerated, and wanting to know a little bit more about how the department anticipates or plans addressing that increase, and also providing treatment services for that increase, as the fiscal note that we received is a 0-1. So unsure of what the actual impact might be, or what the expectation is, and also what the cost might be for providing treatment to those individuals, because that is the hope, is that folks who are incarcerated for drug offenses will receive treatment.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, the department did identify that there would be a number of persons that would potentially come under our care. We feel that we're unable to put a number on that because we're unsure of the exact number. However, it was determined that it would be minimal. We're currently at an 83% capacity. We would monitor that for any fiscal impacts should we exceed our capacity. However, we are funded for the level that would meet general capacity.
Thank you. Follow up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know in our budget subcommittee for Department of Corrections, we were very clear that we did not want to see another supplement, that we were hoping that we were providing the funding that is necessary to ensure that we don't see that impact at a later date. And I do have concerns not seeing not even an indeterminate fiscal note, but just a 0-1, that the idea is to the public, what we're saying is there will be no fiscal impact. And that's a difficult pill for me to swallow.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, in this particular component, our substance abuse component is the one I'm talking about. We have been lapsing money there. It was approximately $1.4 million last year.
Follow?
Senator Tobin.
And so you anticipate that $1.4 million would cover the number of individuals who may be incarcerated under this additional section of law, and also provide them services.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, we do believe that we have that capacity right now. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from Ms. West? Senator Giesel.
Well, thank you.
Actually, just a quick, Senator Kaufman joined us at 5:23. Please proceed, Senator Giesel.
Sure. So, full disclosure, I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm astonished that you have lapsing funds when substance abuse, substance misuse treatment can be rather expensive. Those medications can cost quite a bit, particularly the injectable. Are we not using those in the Department of Corrections?
Through the chair to Senator Giesel, we are utilizing all of our resources currently, and we do address the needs of our inmates in one way or another. We work closely with our substance abuse treatment providers, the residential as well as any treatment that might be available for those furlough offenders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Ms. West? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to now move on to the committee substitute that's before the committee. This is going to be the end version of the legislation. First, I do want to recognize that we had a committee amendment deadline. There were some amendments that were submitted and that were to the Y version that we adopted at the last meeting. And before us is version N. If we do take up amendments and they're adopted, they will be conceptual amendments to the N version. But we will be able to proceed with those. But first, here to provide a summary of changes for the committee substitute is our Judiciary Committee aide, Brianna Kakarik. Brianna, if you would please come forward in front, put yourself on record, and explain the changes from the Y version to the N version.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Klayman. In the committee substitute to House Bill 66, version N, we included the following changes in Section 30, AS 1263.010, page 22. We deleted appear in person at N, end in two instances. In Section 4730.706, subsection B on page 30, line 22, we deleted after entry of the ex parte order and inserted after the respondent's arrival at the evaluation facility. In Section 4730.715 on page 28, line 10, we deleted under AS 4730.705, subsection A, or 4730.706. And then again in Section 4730.715, we deleted Section AS 47705 subsection A, or I think I had a typo in that, so I will correct that and get back to the committee with the correct section. But moving on to the next change, we added affirmative defense to the murder in the second degree. We added two new bills into the legislation, including House Bill 11, crime, assault in the presence of a child, House Bill 28, access to marijuana conviction records, House Bill 286, crime victim restitution, and then that resulted in some conforming changes, including a title change and renumbering. Thank you.
Any questions about the committee substitute? Senator Tobin, I wouldn't also note that we also have Angie Kemp and Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law available questions as well.
Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible that we can get a document that tells us the summary of changes? As I don't see it available on BASIS and I don't have it here, and it's hard to follow, particularly with the complexity of the bill and the size.
Through the chair, to Senator Tobin, yes, I can upload that momentarily. We got to the committee substitute a little late, so I was doing some last minute changes, so I apologize, and I will get what I have uploaded and try and fix the mistake I made before it's uploaded, but I'll get that out. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, could I have a motion to adopt the CS as our committee, as our working document?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Judiciary Committee adopt committee substitute for House, or excuse me, Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 66 Judiciary, which is version 33GH 1482/N, as in Nome, as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we adopt the N version as our committee's, as our working document. Next, we're going to move on to amendments before us. First is amendment number one, which is labeled Y.6 by Senator Keel. Senator Keel, if you'd like to move amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll just call it amendment one, or we're going to call it conceptual. Do you care?
This is conceptual amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr.
Y.6.
I move conceptual amendment number one, which is Y.6.
And I'll object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I beg your pardon. I don't have any of these amendments. Is it possible? Are there copies somewhere?
Here. I brought some.
Let's take a brief at ease. Back on record. All right, Senator Keel, Amendment Y.6, Conceptual Amendment Number 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This goes to the use of hearsay at grand jury. And the underlying bill before us effectively allows the use of hearsay at grand jury in pretty much all cases. There are a couple of limits on it, but it is, in my view, really an excessive change in how grand juries work in Alaska. And I know this proposal has been around for a while. I think I've gone 5 rounds with the Department of Law on it, but I'm happy to join round 6. The amendment before you makes a much, much, much more limited change in when you can use hearsay at grand jury. We have a statute now on the books, although I think there's been a court case that makes it difficult to use. This would fix that problem. What we have on the books today before the bill allows, I believe it is a child under, it's either 10 or 12, but a very young child who is the victim of an alleged sex crime. And there's a spanning reference there, which I keep. They don't have to show up at a grand jury. Their information can be provided as hearsay by a witness like a police officer. This amendment would take that age up. Instead of the cutoff being 12, the cutoff would be 16. But it would not blow open the doors wide to use of hearsay at all grand jury proceedings. The role of a grand jury is to buffer between the government and the accused, and it's not a high standard, right? The old joke is a decent prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, which is, of course, an exaggeration. It's what makes it funny. But a grand jury exists. It's in our Constitution to provide just the barest minimum citizen check. Is there probable cause that there's actually been a felony? And it goes back it goes back long before this, but the modern tradition of the grand jury goes back to the 1680s in Great Britain when the English government demanded charges against an earl of something or other, and the grand jury refused to indict because it was political. And our country's founders in the late 1700s were keenly aware of that. So Alaska, with this one limited exception, doesn't currently allow hearsay at grand juries because it's not fair to this defendant in this very, to any defendant in this very, very minimal check. You know, police officers are very good at their jobs. They're professional. And having them instead of the person who saw the alleged thing limits the grand jury's ability to evaluate whether it's likely the thing actually happened. The lack of having eyewitness statements or victim statements at a grand jury deprives a defendant of the possibility of a really meaningful transcript of the grand jury proceedings that they might be able to challenge a trial. It's not common, but occasionally there are inconsistent statements by a witness that might go to their reliability if it varies between what they told the grand jury and what they say in court. Even more, for any number of reasons, right? It's not that people are lying, but sometimes there are issues of memory. It just varies. And the consequences get lower. You can't bring somebody up on potentially perjury for lying to a grand jury if somebody else told the grand jury what they said. It takes away a really important safeguard in our whole criminal justice system where felonies are concerned, the most serious things are concerned. Grand juries, the criminal justice system isn't supposed to be easy for the government. Grand juries are already kind of the easy step. And this is hard. I've been a victim of crime. I've gone in front of a grand jury, and thank God for me, it was just a property crime. I don't want to minimize how difficult this is for victims. But this amendment expands very slightly our very limited exception for the most traumatized people, children, who potentially, I think, would be re-traumatized by retelling the story. But in the most limited of ways to protect the entirety of our criminal justice system. It doesn't get abused because it's hard to abuse it. So, Mr. Chairman, that's Amendment 1, and that's what it's for.
So we've got representatives from the criminal division, either Ms. Kemp or Ms. Schroeder, or both of you, if one of you could come forward and let us know the department's perspective and position with regard to Amendment Number 1, or conceptual Amendment Number 1.
Thank you. For the record, again, this is Director Kemp, Angie Kemp with the Department of Law, and with me is Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder. So just looking at the amendment that's suggested here, as Senator Keel noted, it limits what or it expands what's already in current law. But what's important to realize is what it doesn't do. And first, we'll start with what the frame of reference as far as this particular rule and how it's applied. So as Senator Keel pointed out, it allows, for instance, a prosecutor to offer statements that are typically made to a child advocacy center of, let's say, a 9-year-old, where they describe being sexually abused. Of course, there are other provisions in the rule that require that the states require, the prosecution's required to follow before that thing can be admitted. By raising the age, the amendment will capture children who are 15, 14, and below, etc. It won't, though, capture those individuals, those children who are 16, 17, and 18. It won't capture those individuals who are the victim of sexual assault and they're adults. It wouldn't capture a scenario where a victim or a witness, rather, sees his 3-year-old victim, sees his parents or loved ones murdered, and we've had that occasion. And under the current framework and the current rules, we're required to call that young child into grand jury, absent some other exception. So this limited application, this rule, covers a very narrow subset of cases that we prosecute. And this is something that I think has been certainly the subject of, I don't know if the senators follow the news and some of the letters to the editor that have been written. For example, there was one recently in the Anchorage Daily News that described the problem. Thinking of it even more expansively than, for instance, the 3-year-old who witnesses a murder and has to come in and either some other exception or has to sit and testify. Beyond that, just to give a frame of reference, the state of Alaska typically has roughly, would say, 6,500 felony prosecutions a year, new filed charges a year. Of those, approximately 2,300 are what we describe as persons crimes, so AS 1141, crimes against persons. Even more smaller than that is this narrow application that Senator Keel is describing and where this current amendment and current law allow the prosecution to introduce those statements. So as you can imagine, and I know I've given you some examples where this wouldn't provide any protection for current victims, for victims who have to come in and describe seeing their loved ones murdered, victims who would have to come in and recount, a 16-year-old who would have to come in and recount what could have been the most traumatizing moment in their lives and tell it to a group of 18 strangers. This is the type of scenario, senators, where I have personally had grand jurors ask if I can stop asking the witness questions because they perceive that it's traumatizing her or him. This amendment, while it expands the protections to victims, it doesn't go far enough from the state's perspective or the prosecution's perspective. A couple other important things to, I think, take note of when we talk about grand jury. The case that I think that Senator Keel was describing is a case by the name of, I'll just shortly call it Powell. The case involving Powell was a matter where the prosecution attempted to introduce the statements of a 14-year-old sex assault victim through the Child Advocacy Center statements. So in other words, a statement that was taken in what I'll describe as a very static environment, and she's being asked questions by the forensic interviewer. The prosecution introduced that statement through another means through the theory that that statement would be admissible under another rule called 801 D3 at trial. The Court of Appeals, because there are certain requirements that go along with that, much like the current rule that Senator Keel is attempting to amend, there are certain requirements that have to be met. Well, the Court of Appeals described that because the state, because the prosecution couldn't preemptively meet those requirements, that it was required to have brought the child in, the 14-year-old girl, and put questions to her and asked her about what could have been the most traumatizing moment in her life. So the reason I mention that is because I don't think that it solves a problem that I think Senator Keel believes it does by amending the rule. And I say that because there's still an aspect in the current rule that requires this preemptive analysis, this prospective analysis. And the Court of Appeals has spoken already about what it thinks about that analysis. And they did so in the Powell case. So it is unclear at this point, though we have some guidance on what they would do with this exception. That wasn't what is directly at issue in the Powell case, but it very well gives us some guidance about how to interpret that prospective analysis. So this isn't, I know you've heard me say this before, this isn't something that is outside of the norm, and I don't say that to suggest that the grand jury proceedings aren't an integral and important process that we go through. But it truly is akin to a probable cause analysis to determine whether a case can proceed to trial, not determining guilt or innocence. If you've ever heard me do a grand jury orientation, you'd hear me say that. Although you would also hear me say, you must take your jobs seriously. It's important. However, this is something that is consistent with roughly 32 other states, including the federal government. And when we talk about the statehood and the history behind grand jury and the history behind preclusion of rules of hearsay, keep in mind that when the delegates were talking about that and whether to include a right to grand jury in 1959, or I think it was maybe a year later, 1959, they were talking about the model that was used by the federal government. Well, the federal government doesn't preclude the use of hearsay. So when the delegates were talking about whether to have a grand jury as a buffer, like Alaska does, they were talking about in the context of whether we should, in fact, even have a right to a grand jury, not what rules are applicable. Even maybe more important to think about is that there's case law, a case by the name of Parks, which is an Alaska Supreme Court case, that described that hearsay is, in fact, appropriate and an appropriate foundation for a case at grand jury. There was subsequent cases that followed Parks that reiterated the same principle. It wasn't until 1973 where the rules of criminal procedure were changed to preclude the use of hearsay. So it wasn't a function of something that the delegates did at statehood. It was something that happened through the rules of court and the procedure that was adopted through that mechanism. So I'm happy to, I know I've gone on ad nauseum about this. It's an important topic. I'm happy to take questions if I need to clarify anything.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. I'm not a lawyer. I kind of got lost there halfway through. And so I'm just going to ask some basic questions because I know we had this bill before us. We had this particular legislation before us, and there was a lot of consternation that the legislature shouldn't step into a court rule determination, that there is another entity that goes through this process. So what has changed in the last year?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Tobin. I appreciate that. And Ms. Schroeder reminds me that I need to make it clear what the state's position, prosecution's position is that we oppose. I keep doing that. I'm surprised I haven't called you judge yet, so bear with me.
When you start calling this judge, we'll have to leave.
All right. Well, thank you to answer your question, Senator Tobin. I know that we've had some conversations about this. The criminal rules go through. There's a process that the rules go through. The folks that make up that panel include representatives from the defense. They include the representatives from the judiciary, as well as two representatives from Department of Law. And I know that when Mr. Skidmore had previously testified, he described how long that process can take. and what that process might look like. And while that isn't necessarily a justification to deviate, amending a rule isn't outside the.
I apologize. What has changed? That was my question. Oh. What has changed in the last year?
I appreciate that. Well, nothing has changed. Our position has remained the same, that from the Department of Law's perspective, this is something that the legislature has the right to do and has done previously, as recent as, I want to say it was 2019. I'd have to double check, but there was a substantive rule change that the legislature weighed in on, but it's done it a number of times, and including it specific to this particular criminal rule as well.
Thank you. So from my understanding, nothing has changed. The reservations the committee had previously are still salient.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Tobin. I thought you were asking what, from our perspective, what reservations we had. So I don't know. I don't want to speak for you folks.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
And so, again, you mentioned CACs, and you talked about age, and the first example you gave was 9. I see here in the language that's being amended from the bill, it is children under 10, so that 9-year-old example wouldn't actually be applicable to the current law, from my understanding. But I also know that here in the legislation, it says what is being stricken is hearsay evidence a peace officer is involved in. And from my understanding, in touring a CAC, a peace officer is involved in that evaluation process and listening to the recording or listening to the child talk about the trauma they experienced. So I'm curious, when you talk about CACs, why would this change be applicable to them? Because I think under the existing law, CACs are able to use the evidence that they collect and use it in these grand jury proceedings.
Thank you. Through the chair, that's a great question, Senator Tobin. And I think if I've said something, maybe I made it confusing, but I'll try and recast what I think you've said. So an interview that's conducted at a child advocacy center is taken in a static environment, is taken when typically a law enforcement officer is somewhere in the vicinity, though I think case law has taught us that they can't be doing the interview typically. But it's not the same to say that that interview was captured and that interview is then admissible at grand jury. So there is a distinction there in that, for example, under current law, if a child was 10, because of the way the phraseology is, it's under 10. If a child went to the Child Advocacy Center and was interviewed, that child still would need to come to the grand jury and testify.
I think I'm still confused. Okay. So the current law says under 10. You're saying an under 10-year-old would still have to go?
No, I'm saying a 10-year-old would have to go.
Okay, gotcha.
So it's got to think of it as 9 and below.
And the section where it says hearsay evidence related to the offense, not otherwise admissible, maybe all these pieces, if presented, the hearsay evidence is a peace officer or the observations made by another peace officer in the course of their investigation. So in the CAC where a peace officer is present, they're watching the recording. I've visited the facility in Anchorage. I visited the facility in Bethel. They have the child in a secure room with someone who's interviewing them. The rest of the team watches from another room. You're saying that would not be admissible.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, yes, that would not be admissible. And I think there may be a bit more confusion because there are other provisions in the current rule that, and I think what you're looking at, speak to the availability of officers to summarize other investigating officers and what they did, but not the ability to summarize, for example, what a child said.
Other questions? So I would just generally note that in part of my support for the not supporting the amendment and supporting the version of the bill is that I think for purposes of presenting grand jury testimony that we should not have a different picture for federal court versus state court, that I think it should be easy, whether it's easy or not, it should be the same burden to present evidence in this instance to a federal court jury as to a state court jury. And what this version of the bill does is allows that we're looking at the same standards in state and federal court, and there's lots of federal case law that would address what can and can't. If there's no other questions, Senator Keel, did you want to have any comments in wind-up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly in wrap-up, I hadn't put forward the notion that this the proposal in the underlying bill ran counter to what the founders intended it when they framed the Constitution. I will note, since Ms. Kemp raised it, that Costello v. United States was the keystone case in terms of hearsay at federal courts, and that was 1956. It was a limited holding in a, I believe, tax fraud, but a financial crimes case. And only over many years since and after statehood did especially the Second and Tenth Circuits expand it to where it is today. So if we were going to make the argument of what the framers were thinking at statehood, I think, frankly, it might go more toward limiting the use of hearsay at grand jury. But that's not my pitch. Unfortunately, what's in the underlying bill is so broad that it really does run counter to the notion of a grand jury as a check. And so while I'd be happy to work with any member of the committee on modifying this if there were a compromise point elsewhere, I offer this to provide protection to those susceptible to greatest trauma, but still to protect the integrity of the criminal justice system as a whole. So that's my concluding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. So I will maintain my objection. Madam Secretary, if you could please call the roll.
No.
No.
Yes.
Senator Tobin.
Yes.
Senator Clayman.
No.
Oh, I think I could be stunned.
Absolutely.
I think I was. Senator Giesel.
No.
Senator Coffin.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Yes.
No. So by a vote of 2-3, amendment number 1 has failed. That takes us to amendment number 2, which is noted Y.7. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 2.
And I'll object.
Conceptual. Well, thank you. I was looking at this legislation, and I was thinking about how it has become pretty inclusive of our criminal legal system. And I was watching the House floor today, listening to them debate what happens when an individual is incarcerated. What is the responsibility we have? What is the idea behind restoration? And the amendment before you is the culmination of those thoughts. It would enable incarcerated individuals access to educational and programming resources through tablets. It is a bill that is currently, I believe, on its way to our body and is headed into our direction. And I think it has the opportunity to really help us look toward reducing recidivism and really helping Alaskans who are incarcerated find a pathway toward restoring and repairing from harm. And I could talk more about the program. I think we're all pretty familiar with what the tablet conversation has been, as the language has been in our bodies for many years. I think it started in 2021. It was introduced in previous legislatures, and it is one that people are pretty familiar with when it comes to why do we need to expand access to quality treatment, educational opportunities, and also possibly treatment options, knowing that there is such an expansion of telehealth in Alaska. This would really bring in some additional resources that we may need in our systems of incarceration. So that is why I've put the amendment before you. I think when I look at a comprehensive criminal package, I try to think of all of the different components, the holistic. As we put people into incarceration, I want to also ensure that there are pathways to repair from harm and get out of incarceration.
Thank you very much. Could we get either from Ms. Kemp or Ms. Schroeder, the Department of Law's perspective on amendment, conceptual amendment number 2?
Mr. Chairman, I think
the DOJ has. All right. Well, they can come forward instead.
Good
For the record, this is Terry West, Admin Services Director for the Department of Corrections. I believe we have April Wilkerson, our Deputy Commissioner, online to address this amendment.
And you do... Yes, we do. Ms. Wilkerson. I was looking in the wrong place. Ms. Wilkerson, where does the Department of Corrections position on Amendment Number 2?
Good afternoon, good evening. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, one of the Deputy Commissioners for the Department of Corrections. We are neutral on this amendment. We're very supportive of the legislation. We do agree with what some of the items that Senator Tobin was saying, is that we look at these as an option for the Department of Corrections to expand and increase its efficiencies to provide reformative programming to the offender population using technology. We do have a zero fiscal note associated with that amendment and that legislation, and that's because this just provides the department the ability to offer tablets to the inmate population. And what our goals are is to identify efficiencies and efforts to provide these this technology to the population within existing resources. However, if we find that that's not an option, we would come forward in a future budget request to the committee or to the legislature.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the Department of Corrections? Ms. Wilkerson, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I track the statement. The department supports the standalone legislation and is neutral on the amendment that rolls the legislation into this bill.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, sorry for that. Yes, that is our stance.
Follow-up?
Nope.
Senator Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm wondering, are these connected to the internet, the tablets?
Through the chair to Senator Kaufman, no, they are not. They are on a closed network. We currently provide computers to our inmate population on a very limited structured basis, and it's very limited to like digital law library, or we'll have a computer that has policy, the department's policies attached to it, or some education curricula. So these tablets, there are providers that operate very closed, structured, monitored, recorded network within a facility, and that's what these would operate off of.
Paula?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, and so they would not be delivery vehicles for telehealth, I assume, if they're not connected.
Through the chair to Senator Kaufman, we would be able to use, so like in Goose Creek, we offer video conferences for court hearings. That's a pilot project that we've been running out of the Goose Creek Correctional Center, and we're connecting a couple different court functions for that. We would be able to, in a secure setting, provide that level of, whether it's telehealth or telepsychiatry or remote learning options, we would be able to have a very secure, structured network connection for those on a monitored basis.
Hello. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. And I've not looked at the underlying bill. The quality of the tablets are such that the glass could not somehow be broken, extracted, and used as a weapon?
Through the chair to Senator Kaufman, that's correct. These are our correction-grade tablets. They're not the tablets that you or I use or that we give our children, nor the access. So the providers are providing these type of technology throughout other correction settings, federal and state and local. And so it's something that we would copy from what those correction settings are going are have in place. We currently have a pilot that we are looking at. It's a female prison in Eagle River, our Highland Mountain facility. We have about just over 300 tablets that are deployed in a very structured. They only have access to attorney-client contact, and whether that's video visitation or telephonic. And then they also have access to the law library and policies at this time. We would look at adding in education and remote learning, and the telehealth is what we are hoping to expand that to in our next steps.
One more follow-up.
Senator Kaufman.
And thank you. Through the chair, and I believe I heard you say this would not incur additional cost because it is seen as an efficiency. Could you confirm that or expand upon it, please?
Yes, thank you. So through the chair to Senator Kaufman, what our goal is to, you know, as we have providers that are not able to come into the facility, that maybe we can utilize that funding as part of the fees associated with the tablets to have educational learning or curricula on the tablets. Identifying efficiencies that would help alleviate some of the manual labor that we're doing right now that eliminates and reduces some of the overtime that we're working or some of the officer or administrative staff burden in the institution. So freeing up those other costs and those other areas where we're spending monies that can be re-diverted onto the cost of the tablets.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not really a question so much. You know, the underlying bill is talking about court rules and sentencing and commitment procedures. It seems, I'm just going to comment. I don't have anything against the idea of tablets and food purchases and karate and judo. It just seems odd to go into criminal justice. I'm just saying, that's all. It isn't really a question.
A question not for the Department of Corrections, but Senator Tobin, there's a House bill that's, I think, making some progress even today on the House floor. Is there a Senate companion, and what's the status of the Senate companion of similar legislation, if there is a Senate companion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, that is a good question. I don't know if there is a Senate companion that is being considered by the other body or if it's still here in our body. I apologize that I don't know that answer.
At least it's not your legislation to be.
It is not.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? I will note. Oh, Senator Kuhn.
The Senate companion bill, I believe, is in its first and only committee referral. I don't believe that it has been heard.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I would note I'm going to maintain my objection. I somewhat consistent with Senator Giesel's comment. I actually have watched this legislation in both the House and the Senate in past years, and I've often been frustrated that it hasn't gotten through. But the fact it hasn't tells me that there's probably more discussion that we need as a legislature in both bodies before we add it to a bill like this that I'm trying to have parts in this that has broad support, particularly from the administration and the criminal division. So for those reasons, I'll maintain my objection. Senator Tobin, would you like any closing remarks?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could call the roll.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Tobin.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Clayman.
No.
2-3.
So by a vote of 2-3, amendment number 2 has failed. That brings us to conceptual amendment number 3, also noted Y.8. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I will not be offering that amendment this time.
Right. That's all the amendments. And I think next, could we have any further discussion with regard to the end version of the legislation before we move it on? Hearing and seeing. Oh, Senator Tobin, did you have comments?
Thank you.
I can't tell if that was a signal you wanted to speak or not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will not be objecting to the forward progress of this bill, but if there were an objection, I would be voting no, and I want to tell you why. And I think it's important for the public to know. You know, I was reading a book earlier today entitled How We Keep Us Safe. And the book underlying premise is how do we build inclusive, healthy, safe communities? And there was a quote that really stuck out to me, which is the opposite of criminalization is humanization. And it seems to me that this legislation before us does quite a bit to increase the penalties, increase our systems of incarceration, and to potentially increase the opportunities for folks to be incarcerated. And I'm not against criminal justice, and I'm not against the rule of law, but what I am and what I do have fears of are increasing folks' stay in our systems of incarceration and not providing them an opportunity to restore from harm. People make mistakes. People make mistakes for a variety of reasons, particularly when you are hungry, when you aren't able to read, when you have been assaulted yourself. Here in the state of Alaska, we have the highest rates of child sexual assault, and those young children become adults. And unfortunately, there are cycles that we continue to fail to disrupt. I have significant concerns with the components of this bill that deal with folks who are considered incompetent or have mental health issues. We are in Mental Health Awareness Month, and we have a duty to really think about the complexities of how our systems of incarceration affect significant subpopulations. And this is one, although it's small, there are things that need to be considered and taken into account. And I fear the unconstitutional detainment of individuals without due process. I think it's really important for us to think about how and when folks receive treatment. I've been recently reading some CDC data that is showing a significant uptick in the overdose deaths of folks who have been released from incarceration just as recently as 2 weeks. I don't think we're doing our job to help folks find and restore the harm that they have perpetuated, be rehabilitated, and re-enter our communities, and then be able to thrive. And so I understand the underlying bill is a victim rights bill, and it's a bill focused on that section of law. But when we're looking at things comprehensively, I think we have a duty to be more inclusive and holistic in our approach. So I appreciate the work that you've done. I very much appreciate the work that your staff has done. I just cannot in good faith be someone who supports this bill in its entirety, especially as I've not had an opportunity to read the entire thing. But I will not be objecting as it moves forward in this process.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Hearing and seeing none, Senator Keel, could I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Judiciary Committee report committee substitute. Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 66, Judiciary, which is version 33-GH1482/N, as in Nome. Let's see, sadly not amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as well as any forthcoming fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing none, the bill will move from committee. We will continue on to our next bill, and please sign the paperwork as it comes around. We won't take a pause. The last item on our agenda is Senate Bill 223, Assistant Adjutant General Appointment, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We had hoped to hear it yesterday, but we ran late on the floor. And here to present the bill is Angela Flame, Legislative Liaison, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and available online for questions is Deputy Commissioner Craig Christensen. Have I got it, Ms. LaFlame? Is that the right pronunciation?
It's LaFlame, but thank you.
LaFlame, I apologize.
Thank you. Good evening, Chair Clayman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela LaFlame. I'm the Legislative Liaison for the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And unfortunately, Deputy Commissioner is not available on the phone this evening, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to answer any of the questions that you might have regarding the bill. SB 223 seeks to expand the pool of potentially qualified candidates for two positions within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs by changing an existing requirement to a preference. The Assistant Adjutant General, or ATAG, serves as both a state director and also holds a military designation as the commander of the Army and Air National Guard, respectively. There are limited positions within the National Guard that meet the required federal designations for these positions and has proven challenging to find candidates over the years. SB 223 would remove the language requiring 5 years of service in the Alaska National Guard for an ATAG at the time of appointment and would create a preference for a candidate with that previous service. This change is consistent with existing statute language for qualifications for the Adjutant General who appoints these two positions, and would expand the candidate pool to include anyone who meets the federal requirements of the position, such as someone leaving active military service who would like to stay in Alaska. The department would like to keep the preference to reflect its intent to continue to practice, to continue the practice of seeking applicants, of course, within our organization. So I'll pause there for any questions and continue with the sectional analysis at your direction.
The only question I have is we're in this interesting place right now where we can appoint the Adjutant General without them having this required service in our National Guard, but the deputies, we would require them to have served in our National Guard.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Please proceed with the section. Unless there's other questions, please proceed with the section.
Section 1 of the legislation amends AS 26.05.180, letter A, relating to headquarters staff of the Alaska National Guard regarding appointment and qualifications of an assistant adjutant general by adding the statement of preference for a person with at least 5 years of service in the Alaska National Guard and removing the existing statement requiring that service. Just for a note, line 14 provides a few minor formatting by adding a comma and removing a dash. Not sure. Law thought that would be good for that bill. Section 2 establishes the effective date of this legislation.
Any other questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. LaFlamme, there are some other requirements for these jobs. This isn't just 5 years in the Guard, Alaska Guard, or 5 years not in Alaska Guard. Could you give us just maybe a little context?
Sure.
What else do you have to have?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Keel, you still have to be a federally recognized officer at an 06 level or a colonel to be eligible for a promotion to a federally recognized general grade officer, which would be a brigadier general or 07. We have to meet those promotion criteria on the federal side. There's certain certifications and trainings that you have to have. You have to have board approval, so go before a board. You have to be in good standing. And then that's a congressional delegation. Moving from an 06 to an 07, you get put on a list, and then that gets approved by Congress. So there are a lot of federal requirements. Most people, by the time they get to an 06 level, have way more than 5 years of service in the military. This would allow us to consider everybody with that level of experience and not just Alaska National Guard members.
Thank you, Ms. Trump.
I don't see any other questions. So what we're going to do is open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to provide testimony on Senate Bill 223? And I don't have anyone online, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 223. And any comments from members of the committee? Senator Keel, could I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the, Senate Judiciary Committee report out Senate Bill 223, which is in its original version, I think, 33GS2609/A as in Anchorage, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Hearing and seeing no objections, Senate Bill 223 moves from committee. Please stay after we log out to sign the paperwork. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, May 3rd at 1:30 p.m. We will be, I think we've got a couple of pieces of legislation tomorrow, but none of that we had today. But with that, we're going to adjourn. The time is now 6:15 p.m.